Say goodbye to paperwork. Say hello to a stress-free summer with UltraCamp. Their comprehensive tools help you deliver a successful program with easy online registration, customizable reports, simplified staff management, camper health tracking, and more. Best of all, you can access and manage your program from any device. Visit UltraCamp.com today to learn more. Everyone, welcome back to another episode of the Campwire Podcast. Y'all, we are just days away from the 2024 solar eclipse, and you all are in for an awesome conversation. Today, we are talking with Dr. Laura Pedicolas, who is the
principal investigator
and the lead on the Eclipse Mega Movie 2024, which if you're not excited about that already, you're about to be. But let's learn a little bit more about her first. So, Dr. Laura Pedicolas is Associate Director of Edion STEM Learning at Sonoma State University. She works to engage teachers and students in Earth and space physics participatory experiences using coding, hardware, and experimental design. Dr. Pedicolas has over 15 years of experience in the education and outreach fields. Dr. Pedicolas leads and co-leads NSF, NASA, and Department of Education-funded national science education programs. She continues to create science, technology, engineering, and math, or STEM, activities and curriculum, and to provide professional development for educators on topics in physics, computing, engineering, earth science, and space science, all while leading large-scale programs. I mean, do you have any free time? So, Dr. Pedicolas received her BA in Mathematics and Physics at the University of Oregon Honors College in 1993 and her PhD in Physics studying the aurora at the University of Alaska Fairbanks in 2000. She spent 3 years as a postdoctoral fellow at the University of California Berkeley's Space Sciences Laboratory, SSL, continuing her study of Earth's aurora using NASA's Fast Auroral Snapshot satellite data and computational models. Try saying that five times. During this time, she expanded her research to include developing computer models of the Martian aurora, which continued for several years. Ultimately, she forewent science research to lead the education group at SSL. After 17 years at SSL, Dr. Pedicolas joined Sonoma State University to continue her passion for mentoring underrepresented, economically disadvantaged, and historically marginalized students in STEM plus computing careers. Dr. Pedicolas, welcome to the Campwire Podcast.
Thank you so much. I'm so happy to be here.
I am wildly impressed with your bio, first and foremost. I mean, a lot of those words I was just reading for the first time in my entire life. So,
well, welcome to my world. I'm happy to invite you in.
Yes, happy to be
invited
here.
Into your world.
Well, thank you. Yes. Okay, let's go back to the beginning. Just, you know, first and foremost, what inspired you to pursue an education and a career in STEM?
Well, I've been told by a longtime friend, family friend, that when I was in second grade, I told her I was going to be an astrophysicist. Now, I don't remember that. I remember thinking in third grade, maybe I'd be a firefighter or an architect or a scientist.
Sure, yes.
But then in sixth grade, I had this substitute teacher for a week, and he loved NASA, everything NASA. And every day he was showing us new NASA stuff. And I just remember my friend and I, we were sitting next to each other. I was just always having my hand right. I was always raising my hand and trying to answer the question. He finally had to say, okay, Laura, you don't get any more. Like, he was giving out NASA stuff. And he's like, we can't give you any more NASA stuff because other people in the class have to have some. So that was my first memory of being super excited about NASA. Then I had this amazing teacher in middle school, and she actually applied to be on the shuttle program that ultimately blew up, and we all were watching back then. It was so heartbreaking. She did not get a final selection and was not on that. But I remember thinking, oh my gosh, like someone's teacher was lost, and just being so sad, but also happy that it wasn't my teacher. So that was a big memory of space and teachers and science and education. And then I went to high school and I had this career development class, and they said, how, you know, in that you had to, you were taking competency tests. We were taking competency tests. And I was like, oh, I want to be an astronomer. By then I had decided I did want to be an astronomer. And I was like, I wonder if astronomy will be one of my competencies. And sure enough, it was there under what I would be good at. And I was so excited. And to get an A in that class, I was a very good student at that time. I had to go and find someone who did what I wanted to do and interview them. And I'm very shy. I'm an extroverted, shy person, which is hard to understand. But basically, as soon as I get comfortable with someone, that I just want to be around a lot of people that I know already. But it takes a little while to get to know people.
Yes.
But so it was really anxiety provoking to think about, like, I have to find an astronomer to talk to. Like, how is that going to happen? So, you know, my teacher helped me. There was a university nearby. I was in Eugene, Oregon. University of Oregon has physics faculty, astronomers. So I went and talked to three astronomers. One, the first one was so excited. And he was like, yes, we need more women in astronomy and you can do it. And then the next one was someone from Cornell, and he was a visiting professor. And he told me, and the astronomer said, you have to be a physicist first. And I was like, what's that? And so he told me. So I went into this Cornell physicist astronomer, and he said, well, I'm sorry, but I have to tell you something, which is women can't do physics.
What?
And he said, you could try, like, it sounds like you have a lot of passion, but I don't want you to get disappointed.
Okay.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah. So I thought, what's wrong with this guy?
Yeah. You're like,
thank you. Luckily, I already had a lot of good mentors. And then the third astrophysicist said, do you like math? And I said, I do like math. And he said, well, that's good, because that's all I do all day is math. So I took note anyways. So I kind of knew what I had to do to make my dreams come true. And I did. So I went to the University of Oregon and got a physics and math degree, got 2 degrees, loved it. I mean, it was hard, no question. Then I decided, I was the only woman who graduated within a physics degree of my class. So I thought maybe something was wrong with me. So I decided I'd go skiing for a while.
Okay, sure. As one does. Yes.
As one does. So I went skiing, and then I found some people who skied with me when used to go up to Alaska and they clean fish. So I cleaned fish with them up in Alaska, and I fell in love with Alaska, but I really missed physics. And I was like, I think I want to go to grad school for physics. And maybe even here in Alaska, because I love Alaska and I love the camping and the fishing and the mountains. And it's just so beautiful. And sure enough, they had a physics program and they launched rockets into the Aurora Borealis. And I was so excited. So I applied and got accepted and went there. And then the Berkeley connection was through that, because they came to launch, people from Berkeley came to launch rockets through the Aurora, and they had rocket. They also had satellites going over the Aurora this fast that I then worked for. So that's how I got connected to Berkeley. And then they were so excited about my enthusiasm, so they hired me, and then I worked there forever. And here, and then I, you know, I'd been there for a long time, and I wanted to, they actually, I was ready to do more education and more, just working with a different population. And Sonoma was that. And I'd worked with the director of the education group here, Lynn Kaminsky, who's an astrophysicist, high energy astrophysicist from MIT. And she was doing such amazing work. So I wondered if she had a job, and she actually was just posting a job. So here I am.
Amazing. Thank you for sharing that. Okay. I have so many questions. One, is there a difference? This may be an obvious answer. Is there a difference between astronomy? I'm thinking like I took astronomy in high school, and I'm thinking of like studying the stars, and it was so much fun. Is there a difference between that and studying space? I guess they're all kind of in the same area. Okay.
It is not in the same area necessarily.
Okay.
When you study astronomy, you studied a lot of things like stars, galaxies, mm-hmm. and even the sun. The sun is a star.
That's another question. Okay.
Yep. And all those things we study using light. So light is coming to us on planet Earth. And we measure that light, whether it's from the electromagnetic spectrum, that's how we say light. But there's parts of the electromagnetic spectrum or light that our eyes don't see. Like there's the ultraviolet light that bees actually see. And there's infrared light that some other animals see. But we see visible light, which is most of what comes off of the sun. Like that's the brightest kind of light that comes off the sun is visible light. But ultraviolet light comes off the sun. Infrared light comes off the sun. X-rays come off the sun. Microwave, like the thing that we heat our food with, comes off of the sun. Gamma rays, super energetic light sometimes is emitted from the sun. So all of that is called the electromagnetic spectrum. And so astronomy really learns about our universe using light primarily.
Okay.
Now, they also use computers and then all the other physics that goes into making these things that emit light. But we can't really study, we have to use our models of these objects and then compare them to the light we're getting.
Mm-hmm.
The thing about space physics is we can actually fly detectors through space and measure like the particles and light and electric fields and magnetic fields out in space. We can measure those things. It's called in situ, meaning when you're in that environment and you can detect it in different ways. And so that's really like, why do we have these two different words? That's why, because we use more of that detection, the electricity and magnetism to validate what we know about space around us.
Okay. I'm learning so much today. This is amazing. Thank you for explaining that. Speaking of the sun, I'm glad you answered my question that the sun actually is a star. I feel like I've heard that and I was like, I just want to verify. What interested you in studying the sun in particular, especially leading up to this eclipse and the one in 2017?
Yeah, that's a really good question. It's a combination of just the fact that the Aurora Borealis, which is my first passion, and what I learned about in Alaska and saw in Alaska. And it's just phenomenal. If nobody's seen the Aurora Borealis, they need to go up to Canada or Alaska.
Is that the Northern Lights?
The Northern Lights, exactly.
Oh, it's on my list. Oh, I want to go.
You must go. And if you go up, what I do know is that from a science perspective, we know that the Aurora is most active in the equinoxes, meaning in March and in October. Now, but you can't have clouds between you and the Aurora. Okay. And so you have to go when there aren't many clouds. And in the past, our weather's changing, as we all know. But in the past, if you went up to Fairbanks, Alaska in March, it would be very, very cold, maybe as cold as 0 to 20 below Fahrenheit. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. But there would never be clouds and there would always be Aurora. And there's a place called Chena Hot Springs. It's hot springs. You can go sit in the hot springs and watch the Aurora.
Oh, I'm here for that. Okay.
So yes, I really recommend that. And nobody's paying me to say that. but that's what I recommend, to see the Aurora Borealis. So my love of light and Aurora. So the Aurora is affected by the sun.
Okay.
And we didn't know that 200 years ago. Humans didn't know that. We've just learned that. Mm. In the last 100 years or so. So in fact, less than 100 years. And so I've been curious about the sun for that reason, since I love the aurora, like, what's making this? And of course, all the scientists who got a PhD studying the sun, you know, they're happy to tell me different things about the sun. And then in 2012, one of my solar physicist buddies, mentors, Hugh Hudson, came into my office in Berkeley and said, I'm trying to start up a project for the 2017 eclipse involving getting people to go to the Path of Totality and take pictures of the sun. And you do education and outreach and talk to people in the public. Do you think that's possible? And I said, yes, that's definitely possible. And he said, do you want to be part of that project? And I said, yes, I definitely want to be part of that project. And that's kind of how I got into the business of solar eclipses.
So what all did you learn from the project in 2017?
Well, we learned that people will go and take pictures of the sun with their own equipment. We learned how to take all those pictures and rotate them and put them in the center of a, you know, you can imagine people taking pictures. They're not necessarily centered. Mm-hmm. And the angle, you know, where the picture is taken might be different than someone else. So you have to like orient the picture correctly. You have to get it in the right place. You have to rotate it. So we wrote code. Well, my colleagues, some students at Berkeley, mentored by my colleague Juan Carlos Martinez Oliveras, he mentored some students to write computer code to do that all for us. So we learned how to do that. And it took fits and starts. We went down one path and then we would all try to run it. And then we realized it was either taking way too long or it wasn't giving us the results we wanted. And then we had to go down a different path. And then we have the atmosphere between us and the eclipse and the solar corona. So then that creates some changes to where the star that we were using, the star Regulus, to align the photographs. And that was changing where the red star was. We didn't have information necessarily about the pointing people had, so we couldn't use kind of traditional techniques that astronomers use to orient all these images. So we had to learn how to do that without that, and we learned that we really needed some calibration frames, we didn't want people to have to take calibration frames because we were so worried about scaring away people. Take your camera for the first time ever, take a picture of the eclipse and do this and this and this and this. So we didn't do that, but we really did we needed that. So this time we really are, thanks. So this time we're having our volunteers or our participants, we call them science participants because they are part of our team.
For sure.
And our science participants, our engineering photographers, they are going to take all of these other photographs with a lens cap on and of a shirt, white shirt, so that we can basically get rid of any artifacts from their camera.
Oh, interesting.
Because
go ahead.
No, we just found lots of artifacts that then made it hard to analyze the data from 2017.
Interesting. So what was the final product from the 2017 project?
The final product was a video of everybody's photographs stitched together from Oregon through Nebraska down all the way to Tennessee and North Carolina and South Carolina, all put together. And then it was really cool how I thought it was really, in fact, we've had volunteers tell us how cool it was that you could see where the volunteer was next to the, so it was a video that showed both the shadow crossing the, you know, the continental US and where the volunteer was when the picture that you're looking at was taken. And so
that is really cool.
Yeah, it was really cool.
And we've got a link to the 2017 mega movie. So we'll put that in the show notes so people can go back and watch it. So how long between the day of the eclipse in 2017, how long did it take to finish the final project?
For that video to come out, it took about 8 months.
Oh, wow. And how many volunteers did y'all have? Sorry, participants.
We had about 1,300 people submit photographs.
Wow. Okay. Yes. That's a lot of photos to work through. And I'm sure they probably took more than one.
We had 50,000 photographs. Some of those were cell phone photographs.
Okay.
But this time we're focused on DSLR cameras, which are kind of the bigger cameras. People who were part of our project in 2017, they spun off another NASA project called Sun Sketchers. Sun Sketchers is a phone app, participatory science project.
So anybody can do this?
Yes.
Oh my goodness. We're going to put a link to that as well. I want in on that. That sounds so fun.
Everybody should do that for their cell phone. Cause that one is you set up your phone to point at the sun and you push go. Yeah.
We'll include a link to that as well. Okay. So how long, I guess we've known for a while that the 2024 eclipse is approaching. How long have y'all been preparing for this iteration of the project?
Well, let's say that the 2017 eclipse was in a way preparation for the 2024 eclipse. We knew in 2012 when we started preparing for 2017 that 2024 would give us a second shot at doing the Eclipse Mega Movie. So probably I could say since 2012.
Okay. Yeah. So a minute. Sure.
Yeah. I also wanted to just acknowledge a Google team that really supported that movie. They were called the Making and Science group at Google. And they had software engineers helping us and managers, and they helped put together the very first movie that was released 2 hours after the eclipse was over.
Okay.
And that was just so that blew my mind, and it was not as straightforward. It was quite stressful, actually, but they did it.
Yeah, that's amazing. That is efficient. So I guess between the 2017 final product, do you all expect to see any different outcomes between the 2017 eclipse and the 2024 eclipse? Do you feel like they're going to look pretty identical, or do we expect them to look different?
No, they won't look anything alike. So the sun is very dynamic. I know, we just think of the sun. It comes up, it goes down.
I know. I'm like, the moon is going to do its thing and then, or whatever. And
exactly. That does its thing. Mm-hmm. But actually, so one cool thing is that there's music that talk about the spots on the sun. And there are spots on the sun. The spots are called sunspots. And they show up on a regular basis, period. Every 11 years, you have tons of sunspots, hundreds of sunspots. And then 11 years later, you have no sunspots. And then you go back 11 years later, you have tons of sunspots. And, you know, it's kind of, it's a curve. It's not like it's just none and then tons. It's like over time, over the years, you get more and more sunspots. So we call the phase of many sunspots solar max. And we call the phase of no sunspots solar minimum. And we are going from solar minimum to solar max. We're in fact probably in solar max or close to solar max, meaning we have the maximum number of sunspots that we're going to have in this 22-year cycle. And 2017 was during solar minimum. And so we had very few sunspots or no sunspots. There were a couple sunspots that appeared during the eclipse, actually, or right before the eclipse. So that was kind of cool. But it was basically a very quiet sun, and that changes what the atmosphere looks like in the sun, the solar corona. So the solar corona is going to look very different this year because of solar maximum. And in fact, our NASA colleagues have created this year called the Heliophysics Big Year. And that Heliophysics Big Year is because we're in this year of solar max, and we have all these amazing NASA satellites up studying the sun and the eclipse, so we can study the sun from Earth as well. And the solar corona. So the movie that we see, not only will we be able to make it more defined and interesting, it will be able to see more features in the video that we create because of these calibration frames. And we've asked volunteers to take more photos and more exposures, because of that, we're really going to be able to pull out so many more features than we were in 2017. And there will be so many more features to pull out.
Yes. That is fascinating. I think it's safe to say that artificial intelligence is more prominent this year than it was in 2017. Is artificial intelligence, is that something that you all use when studying the sun?
Yes. The answer is yeah. I have not yet. Okay. I'm starting to, but colleagues of mine use, it's a subcategory of artificial intelligence called machine learning. And they are using that with NASA data.
Okay.
And we tried to, so Google is one of the companies amongst many and many researchers that have kind of spearheaded some of the artificial intelligence and machine learning, the machine learning and artificial intelligence field of study. And when we worked with them in 2017, they were curious about whether they could use any images of solar eclipses they had as a training set to help us analyze our 2017 eclipse data.
Mm-hmm.
The answer was no, not at all, because there simply were not enough photographs of solar eclipses to use within the Google database. And you have to have a pretty big set to then to have your machine say, oh, this is an eclipse. And in fact, a funny kind of anecdote about that is one of the software engineers at Google named David, he tried this and he said, we keep finding toilets, pictures of toilets.
Oh, because no.
It's a circle.
Right. Right.
So he's like, it's not working. But now we have the 2017 data set. And so when we wrote our proposal to NASA, we said we could use the 2017 data set to create a training set to now look for particular images within our data set. And in fact, there's a professor here at Sonoma State University whose field of study is machine learning on images, using images. And so we talked to him and said, would you want to be part of this project? And would you want to mentor students on this? And he said, I would love to. And so he got some money from a foundation to work with students here at Sonoma State University to take the 2017 data set and create a training data set out of it. So they're working on that right now. I'm going to hear about their successes and challenges tomorrow.
Okay. Coming up.
And then we're going to try to bring in coders eventually to create a competition to do various tasks that we want to do using machine learning on the photographs that we're getting. That's and that so we cool. already have.
Yeah. Amazing. So again, we're recording this episode a few days before the 2024 solar eclipse happens. So folks listening may be listening to this after the fact, but for you and your team, what will the day of the eclipse look like for you?
Well, we have several of us going to different locations, and so it will be very different for each of us. We have one person in Mazatlan, Mexico, on vacation, actually.
Mm-hmm. So, well, sure.
She's acting as a volunteer for that trip. We're not allowed to travel to foreign countries on our grant. So just want to make sure that's very clear. That's all her being a volunteer and having a fun time, but she'll be doing that anyways. And then we have officially Hannah Hellman, our communications specialist, is going to be working with NASA in Indianapolis. And she may want to speak a little bit about that. And then I will also be taking vacation, but not vacation, to participate in the eclipse, to hopefully see the eclipse. I have my camera. I have software on my machine that should help me take the pictures that we want everyone to take. So I will also act as a eclipse participant, photographer participant. And I also will be with a lot of my graduate school friends back who I met in Alaska. And they are, a lot of them are still in space physics and professors, or they work for various organizations around our country. And that will be fun because I'll get to see them. We're one of our friends grew up on a ranch in Texas, and that ranch is under the Path of Totality. Okay. So he's invited us to be on that ranch, and
nice.
It's going to be a very special time. And then, of course, I'll be talking to people of the press, and our team here at Sonoma State and at UC Berkeley. So we are two of our team members at UC Berkeley. One is also going to be at Mazatlan, and another one is going to be in Texas also. And so they're one of them is a scientist, space scientist, who I mentioned before, Juan, Dr. Martinez Olivares, and then Igor Ruderman will be in Texas. He's helping Troy Wilson here at Sonoma State with the gathering the data. So mm-hmm. people will be uploading the data. So Troy will be here at Sonoma State, and he will be making sure that our survey doesn't crash. That allows people then to get links to upload all their photographs.
Yes.
So he's going to be posting that website right during that day, so that if people are in a place they can upload right away, they'll be able to do that and they'll have the instructions. So we wanted that timing. We don't want it to go live before people have their photographs because we don't want to get all the spurious data. So he's going to be there to get it all timed right and then up there. And then if there's any tech problems, he'll be there to help us. And then our other technician and physicist staff member here, Jeffrey Reedy, he helped with the tracking mounts. So we use this thing called a 3D printer that basically uses kind of a plastic ink to print materials, and we printed a structure that then we put a motor in and a little computer in, so that we could so our volunteers could track the motion of the sun across the sky as their camera was taking pictures of the sun. So it keeps the sun centered in the picture, which will help us then with the analysis. And then some volunteers already had it. It's called a tracking mount, sun tracking mount. So some of our volunteers already had a sun tracking mount, but we shipped those out. So he's going to be here also, kind of on the ground. And then another co-investigator of physicists, a professor of physics here at Sonoma State University, he'll still be here at Sonoma State for any questions about the physics, but we won't be doing physics that day.
Scale operation you've got going on.
It is a full scale operation.
Hey, Hannah, do you want to come on and share what you'll be doing?
Yeah. So I'll be at the Indianapolis Speedway, where NASA has an official big event planned called a Sunspot, which I'm sure you remember Laura speaking about.
Yes.
And there are going to be sunspots across the Path of Totality in major cities. I know there's one at the Dallas Arboretum as well, and then the one at the Speedway. So there's going to be all kinds of Speedway activities. Like, they're going to have drivers of the NASCAR cars, and I'm sure there will be at least one race for people to watch. But I'm going to be helping I'm going to be talking about Eclipse Mega Movie wherever I can. And I'll be trying to meet as many photographers as I can. I'll also be trying to take pictures of my own with the 3D printed mount that we built. And really just kind of hanging out with people. And it's my first total solar eclipse, so I'm really hoping for no clouds because I would love to see everything.
Yeah. Oh, that's so exciting. That sounds like a blast. Yeah. Thank you for sharing.
It's going to be totally.
All right. So what are, Dr. Petacolis, what are you most looking forward to about this eclipse?
What am I most looking forward to about this eclipse? There's this moment during a total eclipse where the sun starts to come back. That's how it feels. Mm-hmm. It feels like the sun disappears and then the sun comes back. not unlike a storm passing through, except there are stars in the sky. And you could see the corona and the chromosphere. And actually, I was reading an article by the person who is leading the whole science division of NASA. Her name's Nikki Fox. And she said in this article how when you see the sun with your own eye, when you see this solar corona and chromosphere with your own eyes, it's as though the sun is living, because it's moving and changing, and like things are dropping and it's pulsating. And I'm so excited to see that again live with my own eyes. And then that moment when it's over and the moon stops blocking that bright photosphere of the sun that we think of as the sun, that moment of like, wait, this moment, this precious moment is over. I don't know why. It sounds so weird. Like, why am I looking forward to that? I think because that moment makes you realize how precious the whole event was.
Yeah.
Because it's when you're in the middle of it, it's so awe-inspiring, and it's so different than anything I've ever experienced, because it happens so rarely for me that there's a whole physiological reaction. I end up trembling. Like at the 2017, I trembled, I was cold, I was so excited, and then to have it go back to daytime was just like, what? Wait, what? No, what? And then to look around and see how all these people that I care about in some way, like in 2017, it was that team, the Google team, and my team at UC Berkeley, that we worked together so hard to do this project, and they were all there and had just witnessed this experience with me. And to just be so, that feeling of gratitude and connection to all the people who just saw it, and even the people who didn't see it, who maybe saw the partial and played with shadows, like here in California, you know, it was supposed to be sunny, so people all have this opportunity to play with the shadows of, you know, you get to see the sun, the partial sun, partial eclipse in all these little shadow ways. It's just so cool. And it's just this moment of connection. It's a moment of connection to our solar system, to each other. And I think this was true in 2017. We were starting to become a divided society back then, even. And, you know, politically and in terms of our values, we forgot that we're all human beings, mm-hmm. and we all come from families, and we all maybe we're making new families because we don't want to be part of our families, or we're very connected to our families, or we're, you know, all, you know, that is true for all of us. And we all are on this planet Earth under the sun, and we really are way more similar to one another than we think. And it's that moment, like when the sun is coming back, it's like this moment of, right, this was a reminder that we are all connected, and we have to remember that when we make our decisions, our political decisions, our everyday decisions, when we wake up in the morning, the attitude we have mm-hmm. about life, because we have, as far as we know, we have one life, you know, no matter what our beliefs are, we may have multiple lives, we may have an afterlife, but all we know for a fact right this moment is we have now, today, right this moment. And how do we want to spend that moment? So that's what I'm excited about, that memory and just being reminded of all of that.
That was so beautifully said. And you're exactly right. And how cool that you got to experience that, and you're about to experience it again. Yeah, that's really awesome. Pivoting just a little bit for a second. So beyond your work with the Eclipse Mega Movies, tell us more about the science education programs that you lead.
Oh, I would love to. I love our science education programs. So I just have to do a shout out to the director of our group, Professor Lynn Kaminsky, because she has been such a great mentor to me since I got here in how to teach students about science by incorporating computer science and engineering and coding and computational thinking into what they do. And she is a high energy astrophysicist turned professor of engineering and physics and astronomy. And she just has an amazing grasp of how to just make some really hard things very tangible for students. And we are just constantly pushing on that envelope, because as you may know, a lot of people who take science, they don't think of coding as part of science. Mm-hmm. And they don't think about the fact that to do science, you have to have some engineers involved and engineering, and in order to make whatever it is you're creating, to take the data that you take to analyze it, and then you use coding to analyze it. And so it's really this kind of holistic system that we use as scientists. And we're not training our students to do that so much. And so there's a big push in our country right now to start thinking about how do we do that? And is it a computer science pathway? Do we incorporate coding and engineering into our science classes? Do we teach engineering as a separate class? If we have computer science, engineering, and science all, then how do we teach all the content we want to teach? So it's like this very hard problem that our country is going through, and we get to be a part of that. So one of our projects is called Learning by Making. And the making piece is about this coding and building circuits and creating experiments to ultimately study something around us, whether it's erosion and how soil holds moisture, or if it's understanding how light is absorbed by black paper versus white paper and then heats up the environment around it or doesn't. And what is the difference between temperature and heat? And then we incorporate, this Learning by Making project was a high school project. And we just got funded to take that high school project and expand it to middle schools. And so we're really excited to think about how do we take this currently ninth grade curriculum that's a year long and teaches all these skills and take it to students in middle school and make it, you know, appropriate to those grade levels and relevant to the standards. And so we're very excited about that. That's a Department of Education grant. And then we also take a lot of those same concepts into other grants. So we have a NASA project called NASA's Neurodiversity Network, where we're working with neurodiverse teenagers and schools that serve neurodiverse teenagers, or camps at museums that serve neurodiverse teenagers. And how do we help those teenagers learn in ways that suits their strengths? So we come from a strength-based approach. We know that, you know, if someone comes with some disabilities, it's likely that they come with some strengths in other areas. So we look at those strengths, what can they bring to the learning, and how can we shore up any disabilities that might be there so that they can feel successful in the strengths they're bringing to their learning process. And so we have this whole website about that, and we've tested this all these curriculums. And in fact, we're kind of capitalizing on the eclipse for that as well, because we have a solar curriculum that we built based on actually some of the work I did with some of my colleagues at UC Berkeley. So we work with Brian Mendez at UC Berkeley. He's a planetarium director at the Lawrence Hall of Science now. And we had created some curriculum that we kind of leveraged, as well as incorporating some of these new ideas from Professor Kaminsky's work, and created a 5-session solar science curriculum. And some schools who serve neurodiverse students in Dallas and Ohio are testing out the second version of this curriculum. So they're doing that in concert with the eclipse, so that these students will have some understanding of all these topics that we've talked about today, and then they'll see the eclipse, and hopefully it will be a way for them to really cement or solidify that learning in a real life experience. So we're really excited about that. And then the other really fun things that I love and also is super hard is a NASA project where we're building with undergraduates here at Sonoma State. We're building a little satellite, and we're building it with two other universities. So the University of New Hampshire is the primary university. So the money from NASA goes to them, and then they sub it to us and Howard University. And the idea is to have students in these three very different schools. We're a Hispanic serving institution. Howard University is a African-American serving university. Historically Black colleges and universities. Howard University is one of them. And then the University of New Hampshire serves rural white students or Caucasian students. We've got these three different demographics of students working together again, together, peacefully learning from each other. and I love this project, but it's so hard. You can imagine because we are like 3,000 miles away.
Right.
I mean, it's crazy. We use all these technologies to talk to one another, and we have identical setups so that we can try to help each other with, the different components. And I mean, it's such a hard project. We have a ground station here, which means we can talk to satellites from Sonoma State University. And that had gotten really old. We had to replace the entire thing. So, and I'm not an engineer, I'm a scientist, and I've had to learn some engineering, and it's been really hard for me. And I've been really appreciative of the students in the engineering department because they've been helping so much. They keep teaching me things about radios and signals. I'm like, okay, well, I can explain it as from a physics perspective.
Right.
what are we using here? I don't know, fiddle files and C. Anyways, it's just so cool and crazy and hard and good. And we're all learning. Lots of students have gone through that program. We just counted, in fact, we have 15 students just from Sonoma State who have been part of that project. And I think Howard University has similar numbers, and University of New Hampshire, similar numbers. So that's again, kind of aligned with Professor Kaminsky's approach of, and in fact, her husband, Garrett Jernigan, was one of the founder of our little satellite lab here. He passed away a couple of years ago. So we call it the Jernigan Lab.
Thank you for sharing all that. I mean, I love everything that you just described, especially the kind of creative and innovative ways that you all are bridging these worlds of, what you mentioned earlier, how people think of like science and coding as being separate things, and kind of bridging the gap between those two and seeing this beautiful connection that kind of weaves through all of it. I just think it's brilliant. So I love everything that you just talked about, and excited to see where it all goes. So summer camp experiences, you know, something that is really awesome about kind of any summer camp or out of school time experience is this benefit of, you know, like being able to take positive risks, try new things, become curious. You kind of explain this a little bit in explaining the work that you do, but how do those concepts show up in your work?
That is a great question. I love it. Yeah, I think that because we are trying to think of these holistic ways of having students experience and learn science, it really is aligned with these ideas that you just spoke about. One of the things that our ninth grade curriculum does is it allows students to, once they kind of build, for example, they build this setup to study evaporation. So they have a fan, they have a coffee filter, the coffee filter gets wet, it's on a temperature sensor, and then you watch the temperature sensor measure temperature, and the temperature cools. And then the students have to think about why is that and what's happening. And then they take their ideas of why is that and what's happening, and they get to basically take risks in thinking about, well, what might they want to do next with this experiment? Do they want to change the coffee filter? Do they want to Spray more water? Do they want to spray something else? Maybe rubbing alcohol? Do they want to spray Coke, Coca-Cola on there, or some other kind of soda pop? And in fact, one of our teachers was laughing because she's like, my students were so excited. They brought in coolers from their homes because they wanted to do experiments, and everyone wanted to, you know, bring their favorite drink into class, and then they wanted to test all these features of temperature with their different drinks, and putting it in ice, you know, an ice cooler. So they put ice in their cooler, they filled it up with ice water, and then they put cups with like different types of drinks, and they wanted to see if different types of drinks would cool down at different rates. That was really cool. And one of the things we've been trying to include in the classroom that can't is much harder to do and much easier to do in like a camp environment or an outdoor environment or an informal environment is to take the whole setup that we have with the sensors and the computer and take it outside to make measurements outside. Because we have a light sensor, for example, and that light sensor measures how much light is shining on the sensor. And so you can imagine being outside during the total solar eclipse with this whole setup, and you might see that and then you can measure in terms of the sensor measurement how much your environment outside has decreased in light intensity, and then it increases again. And so that type of risk, you know, all of that's very risky. You may or may not see something. You may or may not. And one teacher for our ninth grade curriculum was saying, there's such a huge risk with this because what if the students make up the wrong idea in their head about what's happening? When you let them do what they want to do. And I said, well, research has shown that students make up what they think is happening, even when you are giving them the right answer.
Right.
and we know that from camp education and informal mm-hmm. education. People come in with their ideas. Students, adults, learners, all learners, we have our ideas and we hang on to them. And people can tell us. I mean, I had a student once tell me that here at Sonoma State that, oh yeah, they knew about sunspots. They were black holes that you could fly through. And I said, no, they're not. You can't fly through them. They're still gas. There's gas. It's the same. It's just a little bit cooler. And he goes, no, I know. I already read on the internet. And I was like, what experiments could I do to like get him to understand what's actually happening? And it's not an easy question, right? Like once someone's really set in what you can do. And I think that's what's so wonderful about these experiential informal environments is you can take the time and be like, okay, well, if that's a real hole, how would you come up with a measurement? How would you take a picture of the hole? What would the hole have to look like? How could we, and then some students could say, no, that's not what happens. You know, how could you set it up so that you could decide, is there a hole there you could fly through or not? Like, what would you need to answer mm-hmm. that question for real and convince yourself? And in fact, that's reminding me of our NASA's Neurodiversity Network curriculum for the very first session for the solar curriculum. We have mysteries, and the students have to say what caused these mysteries. And it could be anything. They can come up with anything. And they come up with things like aliens or conspiracy theory, you know, conspiracy like the government or, you know, some, I don't know. They come up with all sorts of interesting ideas. And then we say, well, what would you need to determine, what evidence would you need to say that your idea was correct? And we take them through this idea of the scientific method. And it's really more the practices scientists use and the engineers use to get enough evidence to convince ourselves that what we think is true or it can't be true because we've gathered evidence that this can be the answer. And it's so risky to do that because students might walk away thinking that, like continuing to think what they think or even think things that aren't correct. So it's been a really interesting, it's an interesting journey that there's a kind of careful dance, because we do want people to come away with things that we have solid foundations in after hundreds of years of research and a lot of different tools and techniques. But we also want students to have those experiences for themselves. So it's this push and pull of self-learning in your own passion, and then all these years of hard sweat and tears and money and effort to really understand something. So I think that's what's hard about a science education in general, whether you're doing it in a camp environment or in a classroom or at a science center, Boys and Girls Club, 4-H camp. I mean, that's what we grapple with as educators, for sure.
So speaking of, I think we've seen a rise in specialty camps such as STEM plus computing camps or programs that are kind of similar to that have STEM programming. For camps that are not necessarily STEM focused or science focused programs, what are some ways that summer camps and other youth serving organizations can start to incorporate STEM activities, programs, or whatever it might be into what they offer if they're not already doing so?
Yeah, that's a great question. I think art is the way.
Okay, there you have it.
because I haven't met a person yet who doesn't in some way incorporate art in their life, whether they're professional artists, which most of us are not, or, you know, we play an instrument, or we draw, or we write a story, or we create YouTube videos, or we create podcasts. I mean, there's so much art out there, and by art, you know, I am kind of meaning humanities, and because in that, so if we take art and then we say, what kind of art are we already doing that may relate to a natural phenomena? Let's just start there, like photographs of the eclipse, mm-hmm. or let's draw pictures of what we saw, and you can do that. If you see a partial eclipse, you can do that. If you see the shadows changing, you could do that. If you see the total eclipse, like drawing what you see. Now, some people hate drawing or they're not able to draw. So what if you sang what you saw? Or what if you wrote a poem about what you saw? Or what if you, there's so many ways to think about how to use art to take that process of observation, whether that observation is through touch or that observation, by observation, I don't just mean through sight, but observation through any of our senses, right? So it could be through touch, it could be through hearing, smell, taste. I mean, how do we taste an eclipse? I'm not sure.
Right.
Taste an eclipse. But
we'll figure that out for the next one.
Exactly. Although some of my colleagues, they make little like out of Oreo cookies, they'll make like the phases of the moon.
Wait, I love that.
So this you can taste the phases, right? Like, let's say you can't even, you just make everyone close their eyes and close the, you know, put muffles, ear muffles on, or earplugs in, and they pick up their cookies and they have to, like, don't touch them, just like use your taste buds, like how much of the white filling has been eclipsed by the outer cookie.
Incredible. Hannah, what were you about to add?
This actually is something I'm incredibly passionate about, is this, you know, the idea of bridging the gap between STEM education and humanities education. Mm. And I think that so often that when we think of science, we think of scientists in a lab, and it's very stuffy and it's very hard to reach. And it's very, you know, kind of too far out there for us to get to. But if we bring in humanities, be it art or like Laura, everything Laura was just talking about, we humanize it and it becomes that much easier to reach. And it becomes evident that yes, we can do it too. And that we can use science just as we use art to express ourselves and to connect with other people. And I think that a lot of times is what we're looking for, even if we may not realize it.
Yeah, very well said. Yeah, and you're exactly right. I think that kind of, it's part of everywhere and everything. You're right. It's not just in a lab. It's all around us all the time. So kind of changing our perspectives and viewing it from that approach, I think could really be something incredible and could help people have a lot of breakthroughs with it, seeing the world in a whole different way. So thank you for sharing that. And so as we approach this 2024 eclipse, what is coming up for you after that? I mean, I think we've picked up on that. You have quite a bit going on. So what's next for you and where can people go to learn more?
Yes. So the next steps are to collect everyone's photographs and to acknowledge them and to celebrate their success and our success as a team. I think we need to pause and do some of that. Then we will be simultaneously doing two things. One will be to test out our, what we're calling, what is known as a Kaggle competition with the 2017 data. And what we'll be doing is setting up small competitions for people who code and want to do some machine learning coding. We provide kind of the beginning code and then people will edit that to some degree. Then they can, in order to try to meet a competition deadline, I mean, a competition goal. And so with that competition goal, for example, we want to have our volunteers in this arena help us match up the 2017 data with NASA's SOHO coronagraph data out on the edges, and then see if we can make a movie from 2017 that includes the NASA data, because we want to do that with the 2024 data as well. So while we're doing that on the one hand, the other hand will be starting to do some analysis with the 2024 data. And I know a lot of our volunteers really want to make one of these high dynamic range images, these HDR images with their own images. So we will be continuing our monthly team meetings with all our volunteers and participants and helping them to do that type of endeavor, whether they use something like Photoshop or they use computer code or they use some tool to create art, essentially. So we will be doing some of that as well. And well, I know that our scientist, Dr. Juan Carlos Martinez Oliveras, will be presenting whatever findings he has in June at the American Astronomical Society conference. So he's going to be trying to just see what he can see in the data, and he'll be presenting that. So he'll be working on that while we're setting up a way for volunteers and participants to help us to finish putting together the next version of our movie, basically, to put together our 2024 movie. So all of that's going to be happening in the next coming months. And then eventually we'll have a Kaggle competition probably 6 months later with the 2024 data. So we have two more years to do stuff and publish. We'll be writing up papers and publishing them. And some of our subject matter experts are solar physicists. They already have plans for kind of how to start those papers right away. And so they will be starting to work on their analyses. And so there's just, yeah, like you said, there's going to be a lot going on with all that. And then we're going to get back to our science education efforts also. So it's going to be, there's a lot going on.
So stay tuned. And we'll include links to everything that we've talked about in the show notes, including some helpful kind of Q&A around like different scientific terms that people might not be familiar with. So we'll put those in the show notes as well. Well, is there anything else that you would like to add?
Well, I would just like to really thank you for this opportunity to talk about all the things I'm so passionate about and really just make it a joy to wake up every morning, because these are the things I get to do and think about. And I love sharing that with people through podcasts and through your network here. So for all of you who are listening to this podcast, thank you for being on here, and come back and listen to all the other great podcasts that you'll find here. So I just want to plug out for your work.
Appreciate that. Well, we so appreciate you joining us today. Hannah, thank you for joining us as well. I feel like I just got like my own individual crash course on the solar eclipse and everything that goes along with it. So this was such a treat. So thank you all so much. And as always, thank you to our listeners for tuning into this episode. If you have not already, please be sure to subscribe to the Campfire Podcast wherever you get your podcasts, and keep up with all things happening at the American Camp Association across social media platforms at ACA Camps. Thanks again, and we'll see you.